The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We've been working with our industry partners and with researchers to do some of these ransomware pre-notifications. We'll find out about infections that have occurred but have not yet been activated. And our field force is on the front line of reaching out and talking to partners saying, you know, we are seeing this activity on your networks. And I just got an outreach from somebody the other day saying, hey, I got a call from this person in the field. They told us about this activity. We were able to isolate it. It's fantastic. And, you know, that's like a great day, right? When you feel like you can help prevent a business from getting owned by a bunch of cyber criminals. And, you know, that's work that we do with our federal government partners, but also with our industry partners.
I'm David Chris.
And I'm Brian Cunningham. And this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 15th, the Ides of March, 2023.
As director of the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Jen Easterly is one of several women at the very top of the cybersecurity pyramid in the United States. A graduate of West Point, decorated U.S. Army officer, and a Rhodes Scholar, Jen has served her country in a plethora of senior cybersecurity and counterterrorism roles, and most recently, before her return to government, was the senior resilience officer at Morgan Stanley.
We talk with Jen about everything cybersecurity, about the need for revolutionary new approaches to emerging threats to our cyber and national security, the recent U.S. national cyber strategy, the cyber offense-defense flywheel, and even where her avatar got her cape.
Jen also talks about CISA's priorities for the coming years, new cyber incident reporting requirements, and new cybersecurity help coming to a city near you. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 15th, Jen Easterly.
Jen, we have a lot of important and timely topics to discuss, and we'll get to those in just a moment, but I wanted to take a point of personal privilege and just note that you and I first met serving together on the National Security Council staff under Condoleezza Rice in the early part of this century, which sounds like a funny thing to say, but I guess that's how old we are. And I just wanted to note in terms of career paths that that time as deputy legal advisor to the NSC is still near the top of my CV, but it doesn't make your bio on CISA's website. So that's how far you've come since then. But all seriousness, your journey from West Point to the White House, to Cyber Command, to Morgan Stanley, I think there's a back in the White House there I missed at one point, to now running the CISA is a moving and important journey. And I think our viewers would love to hear about it.
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Brian. It's great to be with you both. Despite the fact that it didn't make my short bio, you know, the time that you mentioned was really fundamental for me in terms of an inflection point in my career, because as you recall, part of that time was spent working with Dr. Rice to prepare her for the 9/11 commission hearings, obviously working closely with folks like John Bellinger, our friend. And I remember really clearly around that period of time, the co-chairman of the commission, Tom Kaine, sort of famously talked about, we were unprepared. He said, we didn't grasp the magnitude of a threat that had been gathering over some considerable period of time. It was a failure of policy, a failure of management, a failure of capability, and above all, a failure of imagination. And this idea of a failure of imagination really captured me and has kind of been a thread that I have pulled throughout the remainder of my career, but it even goes backward as well. When you think about, you know, I arrived at West Point in 1986. It was still the Cold War. I minored in Russian, thinking I was going to graduate into a very different world. And then in 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. It was peace breaking out all over, the end of history, and classmates that thought they'd be obligated for 5 years were, you know, getting out early. And so it was a completely different world that, frankly, we really didn't see when I got there. And then it's a theme sort of as you think about 9/11, but even in my career after leaving the White House and going to Fort Meade at the National Security Agency, where I served over a decade, time in Iraq, in Afghanistan, standing up the Army Cyber Battalion, U.S. Cyber Command, then going back to the White House and sort of being the head of counterterrorism policy during the rise of ISIS, and then to Morgan Stanley, where I went there to set up our Cybersecurity Fusion Center and ended up standing up the Fusion Resilience Center in December 2019, which was envisioned to be able to respond to any sort of disruptions from cyber threats to technology incidents to terrorist attacks to geopolitical threats to infectious disease. And so ended up being responsible for managing the firm's response to COVID along with our chief medical officer, Dave Stark. So this whole idea of preventing failures of imagination, but also using the power of imagination, what I call the imagination coefficient, to be able to motivate innovative solutions to the most complex technical and operational problems is, you know, something I always think about our time in the White House from 2000 to 2002.
Right. Well, since you now invoked a math term, I'm going to quickly kick this over to David, but just taking it more to the present, Jen, you're obviously the second director of CISA. CISA has been around for around 4 years. How do you see the agency's first 4 years now in hindsight, and what should we expect from the next four?
Yeah. You're talking about coefficient is what you characterize.
Yeah, that's the math term. That's
you scared him there. wow. He may need some smelling salts. Not that I'm any better on math, so I'd have to call my daughters.
I think I'm bad on math too, because I think I just said the wrong years. I was actually with Brian 2002 to 2004. So, you know, the memory goes. So yeah, it's interesting. The second director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. So I did a blog actually to accompany our year in review, and was sort of thinking about what the past 4 years look like. Of course, I came here in around July of 2021, but since the agency was established, a bunch of interesting things happened. First of all, we underwent a massive agency-wide reorganization that had a significant change on our organizational structure and moved us into a more regional approach so that we could better serve our stakeholders across the nation. But that was a big reorg. Secondly, we were designated the election infrastructure, what's called the Sector Risk Management Agency, or SRMA. So we were front and center for many Americans for the first time during the presidential election in 2020. And then, of course, during last year's midterm elections. We also led the nation during several major cyber attacks and vulnerabilities, including the one known as SolarWinds, and then the Log4j software vulnerability that was discovered in December of 2021. We were involved in weather disasters and terrorist attacks, including reducing dangers of bombing attacks and misuse of dangerous chemicals. And then, of course, like the rest of the world, we were in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so it was over the last 4 years, there was a lot that went on with this very young agency. Mm-hmm. But over that period of time, we also matured significantly. We received new authorities, new responsibilities. We have brought in a lot of new talent, and we've retained a lot of our terrific talent here. But even with all of that churn over the past 4+ years, I think it's been an incredibly productive time for an agency really just getting its legs underneath itself. And so it's a privilege to have the opportunity to continue to grow what I think of as sort of a startup agency, particularly if you look at
the key players that we spend most of our time with, the NSA, where I spent, you know, over a decade of my career, is what, 75 years old, and FBI over 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And so I oftentimes think about, okay, you know, where do we want to be in the next 10, 20, 50, 100 years to really grow our capability as America's cyber defense agency? So the decisions that my team and I are making now, I think, set that important path for our future evolution and growth.
You know, we want to talk about the cyber strategy. It's a little document you may have heard of, just came out recently. But your sort of commentary on CISA and DHS and maturity level makes me just want to ask one follow-up on that, which is sort of, I mean, DHS has been around for a while, but I don't think anyone would describe it maybe as fully mature, fully realized, fully actualized. How do you see the progress of DHS and its maturity as against and in conjunction with CISA's? Are you, you know, first of all, do you see yourself as a part of DHS or really as more of a standalone member of the sort of U.S. cyber community? And how do you feel the larger agencies maturing as compared to your own element within it?
I think it's a really good question. I think it's a both and. We certainly are part of the department. And in many ways, it's really helpful because there are other elements of the department that have cyber mission. And so the close working relationship that I have, for example, with Dave Pekoski at the TSA, given their role in some of the work going on around pipelines with respect to cybersecurity and, of course, some of the aviation work. And so it's great to have that close teammate relationship, particularly given the work that we've done following the ransomware attack against Colonial Pipeline. And certainly with respect to Deanne Criswell at FEMA, where we play a large role in the field, working with some of the emergency management folks, you know, we're really on the resilience side, but we also can play a role on the response side as well. And then there are major policy issues that run across the full department. And so you're absolutely right, David. I mean, the department only just turned 20. We had the 20th anniversary, I think, just a couple weeks ago. And so you could say, compared to other departments, it is a bit of a startup as well and is continuing to mature. I think just given the imperative of the threat environment, how different things are from when the department was stood up in 2003 to how things are now, you know, the department has had to evolve and we've had to evolve particularly rapidly, just given the acceleration of technology and the acceleration of the cyber threat. So I would say we're almost moving at an accelerated pace while still an important part of the department, but also a very important part of the federal cyber ecosystem. You know, you talked to my great friend Chris Inglis before, you know, who he and I went through confirmation together, and we always talked about cyber being a team sport and how important it is for that federal cyber ecosystem to operate in a unified, cohesive way. And I've also very importantly seen that mature over just the past 20 plus months since I got here.
Yeah. Now, so Chris, you know, said he's the coach and you're the quarterback. But when we talked to Kemba, she was using musical analogies, not sports. So well, you better just hang on and see what's coming around the corner on those adjacencies.
It could just be a marching band and then you got both bases covered.
Maybe that's right. How to square the
which,
circle.
Which might be the biggest mix of metaphors in 10 words in quite some time. But I mean, to that point, Jen, we can't not ask the cyber lanes in the road question. And, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use, there's plenty of cyber threat to go around, as one of our prior guests said, and I think as you've suggested. But how do you sort of operationalize that? How do you know on a day-to-day basis who's doing what?
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, look, I always get the cyber lanes question, and you all are a very sophisticated group, and as is your audience. So they could probably explain it better than me at this point in time. But just to be clear, so you know, very different from the executive office of the president having an operational component. So the NSC, of course, does policy. And the NCD was stood up to give coherence, to establish coherence across the federal cyber ecosystem. And importantly, they were given the responsibility of developing the national cyber strategy. And big props to Chris and to Kemba and to Rob Kanaki and Harry Krestia, who did an incredible job collaborating with hundreds of partners as that document evolved. And they should be really proud of the work that they did. But when I think NCD, I think cohesion, coherence, strategy, NSC is policy, and CISA is the operational component that does cyber defense. So we actually, by statute, play two key roles. One of them is cyber specific. One of them really speaks to our larger infrastructure mission. But the elevator pitch that I give is that as America's cyber defense agency and as the national coordinator for critical infrastructure security and resilience, our mission is to lead the national effort to understand, manage, and reduce risk to the critical infrastructure that Americans rely on every hour of every day. So if it has to do with cyber defense, we have the lead for it. If it has to do with investigation and pursuit, that would be our bureau partners. If it has to do with intelligence collection and security of the military networks, those are our DOD and NSA partners. And I think the great news is the orchestra is playing very, very well. I just saw Tar over the weekend, actually. So that
look
was
at that
image
seamless
of-
transition to music. I mean, it's like you're just in harmony.
I know, right? But I was saying, I saw Tar over the weekend, and that's okay. What came to my mind when you said the orchestra and Kemba.
Well, even though you're all first chairs, right?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I'm happy to, like, you know.
Well, let me just stop you for a second, Jen, because you mentioned the strategy. Obviously, our listeners are very interested in that. When you started the conversation talking about our time working for Dr. Rice, I thought where you were going to go was the thousands of hours that we all collectively spent on the very first national strategy to secure cyberspace, which was kind of one of my formative moments in cybersecurity. And I paid a lot of attention to those strategies over the years, and they were pretty consistent, even during the switch from President Bush to President Obama. This one, I think, is really quite revolutionary. And I really take my hats off to ONCD and you guys and the White House and the NSC. Two places where I think it's particularly revolutionary are something I know you've talked a lot about, which is moving, these are my words, not yours, financial and legal liability and responsibility for defending against and responding to cyber attacks to those parts of society that are most able to absorb it. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that. And then I want to talk about offensive cyber operations.
Sure. I agree with you. I think it's a really good document. I think there's some things there that are materially different and really important. And the two, you know, you pointed out, one of them is essentially put the security burden on those most able to bear it, which is not the user that doesn't understand the threat and really doesn't understand how to defend themselves. And that's extensible to users, but as well as small businesses. And the second is to really focus on long-term investments for security. But they're really a piece of the fundamental issue. And you all might have seen the Foreign Affairs article that Eric Goldstein and I wrote on this, as well as a speech that I gave at Carnegie Mellon, which is really about the fact that we have normalized a world where we are all now dependent on fundamentally unsafe technology. Why is that? Because incentives have been misaligned for decades. We have incentivized speed and cost and features, but we've not incentivized safety and security. And so now we're in a world where ultimately the security burden is put on those least able to bear it. And we think it's really important to recognize it, to call that out, and to start making a fundamental shift that will put the burden on those, again, most able to bear it, which are the bigger companies and the technology manufacturers who build technology that, again, is not at the level of safety that we need to be able to underpin the critical services that we rely upon every day. And yeah, the discussions, I know there's been a lot of debate, a lot of lively debate about liability. And we do mention safe harbor, of course. But if you create bad software, is that, you know, just generally something that everybody should accept? or if you are not building software products that are specifically designed to reduce the number of vulnerabilities, just expecting everybody to patch that when the patches come out, I think we need to be really, really thoughtful about that, given how connected everything is that we rely upon and how, you know, the vast majority of our critical services are underpinned by a technology base. I think it's a really important conversation to have. And, you know, the point of departure was the National Cyber Strategy and some of the things we've been talking about and writing about. But I hope, you know, I hope we have this debate in a collaborative way and not just, oh, you're going to kill innovation and we're going to fall behind on innovation, you know, relative to our peers, because, you know, we had this discussion on technology safety. There was a discussion about social media and safety related to that, obviously, by folks like Tristan Harris. You saw probably the Netflix piece on this, The Social Dilemma. And now there's some important discussions being had about the safety of artificial intelligence, which is moving very, very rapidly. And I think most people will tell you they don't totally understand it. They don't know what the safety implications are. And this is just all a piece of being able to have an evolved conversation about the safety and security of the technology that we rely upon every day.
So, Jen, how does that conversation, which obviously has been ongoing, really get down to brass tacks? I mean, you're very careful, you and your colleagues in the government are very careful in talking about, you know, the need to lift and shift the responsibility, but you are rarely invoking the R word, or when you do it carefully. So how do you instantiate and get to the place where you want to be with a combination, I guess, of carrots in the form of maybe safe harbors and liability shields, sticks in the form of requirements, and maybe industrial policy as well? How do you actually see yourself getting those new requirements and new approaches implemented? You have legislation you're working on, for example, that you want to disclose, or are you going to use existing authorities or moral suasion, or what's the vehicle for putting these things into effect?
Well, first, as Chris might have mentioned, and if you've talked to Kemba, the devil will be in the details of the implementation of the strategy. So when that work is already beginning, it will have to be across the interagency, but importantly with our friends in Congress, as well as very importantly with industry. As you both know, CISA is largely a voluntary agency. The magic of our ability to be effective to reduce risk to the nation in a world where the vast majority of critical infrastructure is owned and operated by the private sector is really rooted in trusted partnerships, and it's hard to build trust and easy to lose it. So I'm not a regulator, and I realize that regulation has a role, but I also came right before I came to CISA, I came from a highly regulated industry. And so, as you both know, and regulation has its place, but I'm always super mindful about regulation that creates a bunch of box checking as opposed to operational risk reduction. And I worry very much about regulation that is not harmonized. So that's something that we are working with, you know, as part of the cyber incident reporting legislation came this idea of a cyber incident reporting council that's led by the department. And the whole idea there is if we are going to put additional, and this is just for reporting, burdens on industry, which I think are important just given the fact that we have so little insight into the number of incidents that occur. And it's very important to get a better feel for the various things that are going on so we can be much more proactive and preventative. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that whatever burdens are being placed on industry are being placed in a way that they don't become that box checking, that they are harmonized, and that, frankly, they allow the ecosystem itself to be more secure. So I think that's incredibly important to keep in mind whenever you're talking about regulation. I also think, to my earlier point, you know, we are looking at, there is regulation going on with sectors, which is not new regulation, of course. When the White House talks about regulation, this is really making use of the rules that are already in place. And some of the rules that are being put in place, I actually think of they've done, as they've evolved, they've done a nice job in working collaboratively and consultatively with industry. So, you know, in particular, my friend Dave Pakoski, I think they've done well in terms of the iterations they've gone through. But this is not new legislation. So I don't think anybody thinks that that is going to happen. There was legislation. There was some draft legislation that was developed by the Cyberspace Solarium Commission about the liability piece. So there may be people looking at that with respect to the implementation, but I do think that's an important conversation to have. I also think that, you know, at the end of the day, we need to look at the root cause, which is really the underpinning technology. You know, when a company gets breached, you always focused on the company that got breached and why didn't they patch the software? And you don't ask the question, you know, why did you have to patch that software so many times? And why did that unpatched vulnerability cause such a damaging breach? But yeah, I just think we need to think holistically about it.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Yeah, it's a great point. And two of the three of us are lawyers, and Jen, congratulations for not walking that path. So I have to say to our listeners that our friends in the plaintiffs bar are watching this debate very, very closely. And the reason I know that is they're calling me and probably David about potentially being expert witnesses. So, you know, I think from an industry point of view, the senior leaders of some of our major companies have already testified after SolarWinds that, it probably is time for a little bit more regulation. And I think most companies, and I don't know if this is the way you guys felt at Morgan Stanley, but most companies would say, if we have to have regulation, we would rather have very clear, understandable, operationalizable standards from the federal government than 50 different states, as we have now in, for example, incident reporting. So me personally, I wouldn't rule a statute off the books.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, I just think if you have a patchwork, that does not help us reduce risk.
Absolutely.
And so whatever we do, we have to do it in a harmonized way. And we need to do it in collaboration with industry, right? Because industry understands, you know, and I know this from my time in the bank, you know, nobody understands better than industry, those who are operating their systems, what is going to most effectively reduce risk. And so these are performance-based standards, right? Not like the, you know, checklist that is down to the granular level saying, you know, you must do this.
Can I pull a couple of threads on cyber incident reporting? So, I mean, you know, we've got various sector agencies imposing by regulation under extant authorities, different reporting obligations, SEC, TSA, and so on and so on. There's dozens of them, I think, now. NSTAC recently recommended that you deconflict and harmonize all of those. Are you warmly embracing that mandate? That's question one. And question two, I guess, is as you implement CERCEA, are you going to be sensitive to the desire of some of the reporting elements, the cybersecurity or cloud or computer companies, to not have to give up sort of their secret sauce, their own internal sources and methods and analytics, which I think they believe may be better than anything the government has, and they're worried about sharing across industries, you know, through you. So are you going to harmonize, as NSTAC is suggesting, and are you going to be sensitive to exactly what you compel by way of reporting?
To your first question, David, I wasn't fully briefed on it, to be frank. I do believe very strongly in harmonization. I'm not sure about where that should sit within the U.S. government, but I do think that should absolutely be the goal. It just goes back to my fundamental belief, having seen it, having done it, that if you have a patchwork, it will do nothing to reduce risk. To your second question, like, tell me more. I'm not sure I totally understand.
Well, if you look at the implementation questions around CERCEA and you have incident reporting obligations when such and such happens, you know, you have a certain amount of time to produce a response and send it in. But, I think sometimes, and this is pretty common, the companies that are doing the reporting may have concerns about trade secrets or other proprietary knowledge going across the transom to you, then being shared with all other federal agencies, particularly the Bureau seems to be very sensitive about it. You recall Lisa Monaco's comments. And then perhaps being shared with competitors through the sector-specific councils or other interactions. Are you sort of keyed into limiting what gets reported or aware of the concerns in a way that you think you can manage through?
I mean, the short answer is yes, a couple things. And, you know, we're going through the rulemaking process now, so I can't deep dive, as you know. But we endeavored, and I think we were effective and successful in this, to make this as consultative a rulemaking as possible, right? We had an RFI where we had hundreds of submissions. We had, I think 11 listening sessions. I think we're going to do more listening sessions. I mean, we really wanted to...
All over the country, right? I mean, you went door to door.
Exactly. So we wanted to make this collaborative. Again, this is informed of my own personal experience, right? This is not about punishment or enforcement. Quite frankly, this is about two fundamental things. One is about rendering assistance if needed. Now, many of these big companies obviously have IR incident response companies on retainer and don't need the U.S. government, but some of the smaller entities might. So it would be about rendering assistance, but more importantly, taking that information and given our very robust authorities for information sharing in a way that protects privacy. I think that's why the Congress focused on giving it to us, because we had those authorities already in place. Being able to share that information with others across the sector to ensure that others do not get hacked. It's the most important thing that we have is to be able to protect the sector. It's sort of, if you're in a neighborhood, you're going to want to know if your neighbor gets robbed so that you can make sure you're locking your door and closing your windows. I mean, this is about proactively informing others to enable them to protect themselves. It's not about providing IP or trade secrets or any of that. And in fact, we are highly, highly sensitive because, again, we are a voluntary agency that is, everything with us is really based on trust. We're highly sensitive on any fears about sharing information that might impact the reputation of the company. So, we're not obligated to share with regulators. We do work, of course, very closely with the Bureau. Credit to my old boss and good friend, Lisa Monaco. I think they've done fantastic things since she came in as the DAG in terms of their focus on cyber. And frankly, we have a fantastic working relationship between my head of cyber, Eric Goldstein, and Brian Vordran, the head of FBI cyber. It's incredibly collaborative. And, they are very, very focused now on helping victims and also looking to get things like if they've paid a ransom, we saw this with Colonial Pipeline, getting that money back. And I think that entities appreciate that. And I think that's helping to create more trust, right? And so we're doing this as a team, but I really want entities to realize we are here to help. It's not about, stabbing the wounded. It's about protecting the ecosystem. And I think it's really important that people, ultimately companies, particularly part of critical infrastructure, and that's what this is focused on, really collectively put collaboration over self-preservation, because this ultimately is about our national security and economic prosperity and public health and safety.
Well, speaking as we were about CISA expanding, going around the country, and also about helping entities protect themselves, I know you've done a lot of thinking and some shifting into more of a regional model for CISA. So how should the public understand and how should they know when to, for example, reach out to a CISA regional office versus the FBI versus other parts of DHS? What do those lanes look like?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, I have to say, this is the funnest part of this job. When I was in, you know, the military or at the White House or at the NSA or even at Morgan Stanley, I wasn't out in, you know, the heartland of America working with state and local officials and working with business owners. And that is like the most fabulous thing because you see actually the impact that you can make in helping small businesses and working with election officials and others. So it really is fantastic to build out this capability in the field. And so, you know, we are working to grow, particularly in cybersecurity, but we have physical security advisors, we have a chemical security mission, we have an emergency communications mission. So it really is an integrated capability that is out in the field that is just getting more powerful every day because, again, we realize this is all about creating trust and adding value. And so when you ask about, like, who do we go to, I think the right answer is, there should be no wrong door. You know, some people may not want to come to DHS. Some people may not want to come to the Bureau, but we are so tightly connected, both at the headquarters and pretty well connected in the field. Obviously, the field offices are much bigger than our offices, but we'll continue to grow. But, you know, when you come to one part of the U.S. government, you should feel like you're coming to the full U.S. government. That's frankly the theory of the case behind our Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative, because, you know, even as recently as when I was at Morgan Stanley, I did not feel that there was that sense of cohesion. And I think Chris Inglis did a lot to bring this together. But you can go to FBI, and if it's information that needs to come to CISA, particularly if it's reporting, it will come to us. If it comes to CISA, we'll provide to FBI. But you can sort of think about the key advantage to CISA is really what I would call as a, you know, retired Army officer left of boom. So we are in the resilience building space. So what are the things that critical infrastructure owners and operators need to do to raise the security baseline, whether that's cybersecurity or physical security? So we work with all of our partners doing assessments, providing no-cost cyber services to help them raise their baseline. And one of the things I'm most excited about is our work with water facilities and with K-12 school districts and with hospitals. This year, we prioritized that work along with our government partners, EPA, ED, and HHS to really try to drive down risk in those what we call target-rich cyber poor entities, those entities that we've seen pretty badly hit by ransomware over the past couple of years, but really don't have the resources or necessarily the in-house knowledge to be able to raise that cybersecurity baseline. And our field forces are the ones that are at the tip of the spear working with those partners. The one other thing I'd mention that I'm also really excited about is we've been working with our industry partners and with researchers to do some of these ransomware pre-notifications. We'll find out about infections that have occurred but have not yet been activated. And our field force is on the front line of reaching out and talking to partners saying, you know, we are seeing this activity on your networks. And I just got an outreach from somebody the other day saying, hey, I got a call from this person in the field. They told us about this activity. We were able to isolate it. It's fantastic. And, you know, that's like a great day, right? When you feel like you can help prevent a business from getting owned by a bunch of cyber criminals. And, you know, that's work that we do with our federal government partners, but also with our industry partners. It's just really rewarding to be able to make a difference.
That really is important, especially given how, you know, every time I think the cyber criminals can't get any lower, they do get lower in what they're willing to release publicly to coerce people. So that's super great development. Also, really happy to hear you mention the support for K-12, although now I have to call a reporter back that I told yesterday I didn't think there was much support through K-12 because there really haven't been resources for them. So that is a really good development.
Can I just mention one thing? Because for those who might be interested, so there was a K-12 Cybersecurity Act that I think came with the NDAA for 2021. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, we did a lot of work with some experts in the field to include
K-12-6, a great partner, Doug Levin in particular, to provide a guide for K-12 schools to reduce their cyber risk. And so if anyone is on your listeners is particularly interested in this and has kids in K-12, and there's a guide out there on our website, and it's really very good. So I would refer you to that.
Oh, that is great. Yeah, thank you. So one of CISA's taglines, if you will, is as America's cyber defense agency. And you mentioned a few minutes ago the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative. And I noticed that this initiative is intended to unify defenders from organizations, not just governments worldwide. And it specifically includes public-private partnerships. Can you talk a little bit more about JCDC and more generally the government's plans for partnerships, particularly in what we might have historically thought of as offensive cyber operations?
Yeah. So we are squarely rooted in defense world, but we obviously work closely with our partners in the offense world. In particular, we work very closely with U.S. Cyber Command to help inform what they do and what they learn in things like their hunt forward operations helps inform thing that we do on the defense. We actually call it the offense defense flywheel. So, you know, Eric works closely with Joe Hartman, who's the commander of the Cyber National Mission Force. But the JCDC, you know, was another one of these things that just emerged from the brilliant work of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, came with the NDAA in 2021, where we got a lot of our new authorities. And the idea was this joint cyber planning office. But when you look at the legislation, it's about a lot more than just planning. And also, I didn't like JCPO as an acronym. So I thought like a skin disease or something.
Fabulous.
Am I right?
That's how the sausage gets made.
Yeah. So, of course, we had to figure out like what the hell to call this thing. And I love 80s music. So I tried to call it the Advanced Cyber Defense Collaborative, and the lawyers didn't like that.
Right.
Well, you know where that highway leads.
Exactly. Straight to hell.
Talking to a bunch of lawyers, right? I take a Shakespearean butler. But we ended up with the JCDC. And what the insight of the Congress really goes back to this, there was no one platform that industry could go to specific to cyber defense. And so in the legislation, and this is the only sort of federal cyber ecosystem that is in legislation, it talks about, brings together by name, CISA, FBI, Cybercom, NSA, together on one platform to be able to face off to industry on all matters of cyber defense planning and operations. And so we stood that up in August of 21. We brought in our first 10 partners that were largely some of the technology providers because they have great visibility into the threat ecosystem, given how they're positioned in the world. And we've grown that to many, many more partners, not just technology, but finance and aviation and energy. And we were able to operationalize this first in December of 2021, when Log4j, the software vulnerability that we were very, very concerned about, given its ease of exploitation and its ubiquity within critical infrastructure in the community, both within industry and the federal government, and folks like some fantastic researchers who were energized to work on this, all came together in a short period of time to work together to help us get guidance out and advisories to drive down risk, to better position us to be proactive against mass exploitation of Log4j. And there's if you read the Cyber Safety Review Board, you'll see some of the work that we did that really, with our partners, helped to drive down risk. And then, of course, during Ukraine, we worked with our partners to build a Ukraine plan to deal with escalated attacks against critical infrastructure, and to have that in place when in time, actually, we exercised it for several hours with industry and our federal partners in advance of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And so these are, you know, I describe, having seen this for a long time, look, we've all talked about this public-private partnership, blah, 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 right? I mean, everybody's eyes glaze over because it's kind of a hackneyed term. So we were really endeavoring to transform public-private partnership into real time, what I call persistent collaboration, right? It's all based on default to share, collaboration over self-preservation, a co-equal relationship, meaning that we expect industry to play a forward-leaning role on what they're sharing and what they know. And we expect the government to be responsive, to be transparent, to add value, right? So this is not a transactional relationship. This is one that where the parts should come together to create something, you know, greater than the whole, as the saying goes. And, you know, it's not, we like to say it's not a club, it's an engine that is supposed to drive our ability to reduce risk to the nation.
I do want to ask one question, and it's a little bit of a softball, I guess, but I'm interested in how you're going to respond. So following up on public engagement and thinking about you and Chris and Anne, I don't know Kemba quite as well, you know, you all have certain things in common, and then there's some differences. In common, you're all NSA alum. You're all very smart, very substantive, very experienced, as we've seen today in this podcast. But each of you, I think, had a very distinctive style. So Chris, I would say they probably forced him to have a Twitter account. And then he wrote, you know, a foreign affairs article on a new social compact updating Rousseau and approaching the issue from that level. And is more comfortable engaging with New York Times and Jim Lewis. And you've got a Twitter avatar with a superhero cape and a slogan like Shields Up. Did you guys like intentionally adopt different outreach and engagement styles? Is it just a reflection of your personalities? Is yours in part an effort to recruit millennial talent to CISA? What, can you tell us a little bit about how you feel about or how you've approached engagement in that way from a stylistic perspective?
Yeah, you know, I've had my time with Sanger and company and Jim Lewis, and you know, I studied Western philosophy and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and all of that. So,
right.
But you know, I guess a couple of things I'd say. First of all, my avatar, I shamelessly stole that from my great friend and predecessor Chris Krebs. Yeah. So that was
credit where it's due.
Yes, exactly. Give him credit. You know, I spent 21 years as an Army officer, a lot of time downrange, spend time in skiffs, as you know, windowless offices. I spent, as you all know and have done, hundreds of hours in the White House sit room. Like when I got to Morgan Stanley, it was a little bit of like a revelation for me to be in this different world. Yeah. In the private sector, in a firm with some amazing people and an amazing culture in a city that I love. Of in New York City. And in many ways, like I sort of realized the real, the real me, you know. And I just decided when I came back from the private sector, like I wasn't going to change back to my, you know, bureaucratic gen ways. And really, like, you know, and being, I don't know if people have been this vulnerable on a Lawfare podcast, but that's like the real truth. I mean, I just wanted to, and to your larger point, I think it is really important when you think about the challenge of recruiting people into cybersecurity, into technology. You know, it's a world where bureaucracy is not embraced, to say the least. And so you have to have these real conversations, and you have to be vulnerable, and you have to be authentic, and you have to be, frankly, accessible. So, you know, people criticize for me for being out there and meeting with people. It's like criticizing Nate Fick for being around the world, you know, being a diplomat.
Hey, that's his job, right?
And in many ways, right? Yeah. Exactly. It's like my job to build trusted partnerships and to recruit people for America's Cyber Defense Agency. But at the end of the day, like if you wake up in the morning and you don't love what you're doing and you're not having fun and you don't feel like you're making an impact, like for God's sake, go do something else.
Well, yeah. Well, we love the vulnerability, Jen and Brené Brown. If you're listening, come on the Lawfare podcast anytime. And it's great to know where your avatar got her cape. I just wonder now if you need to extend that to have bureaucratic Jen who slides down a pole and emerges as avatar cape Jen. But don't take PR advice from a lawyer ever.
I'll get my comms team on it.
So, yeah, thank you so much for joining
it's
us,
been
Jen.
Terrific.
It's really been great. You're very generous with your time. And a promise/threat, we're going to invite you back in a year or two and see how things turned out.
Sounds great. So great to be with you guys. Thanks so much for taking the time.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare.
You'll get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for the next installment in this series with NSA's Rob Joyce and for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. And check out our written work at lawfareblog.com.
The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha Howell, and your audio engineer for this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.